So I like to start with this plot. You've seen it before. This is what I call our NASCAR diagram. These are all our sponsors. And they are the sponsoring institutions, but they also kind of represent the hundreds of people that are involved in getting to the beautiful data we've been presenting the last few days. And we don't want to forget about them, because everything we're showing is based on work from dozens and hundreds of people. And since this is instrument talk showing up in the middle of the section that was kind of theoretical, I thought we would start back at the universe where everybody feels more comfortable here. That's this background radiation map from Planck with foreground removed. Less scattering surface with whatever lensing we can see in it. A little closer to reality, this is the 30 gigahertz map showing the galactic foregrounds getting in the way of the beautiful CMB. And those photons eventually hit Planck. This is the last thing those photons see before they get absorbed. And this is the same figure that Brendan put up. It's my favorite also, because you get to see the both instruments here arrayed around the focal plane. And something, a couple things to point out is that Planck rotates around this axis, and you're looking as it sweeps past you. And one of the things that was done is that these receivers were aligned particularly to cross paths or to follow lines. So these are the 44 gigahertz receivers, these three. So these two are on a line like that. And as the satellite sweeps around, they cross the same, roughly the same pixels. So that makes it easier to reconstruct the polarization. Same thing with the 30 gigahertz receivers, and then the 70s are in pairs. And that becomes important later when you make quads of these to make tests of subsets of the data. Yeah, actually, I did want to point that out. So there's a lot of space here, and you might wonder why all the LFI receivers are not right up against HFI here in the middle. And it's because if you close your squint, you can see the 100 gigahertz receiver here, the Phantom 100 gigahertz low frequency instrument that was canceled due to lack of funds. And there are also not enough funds to move these guys closer to the focal plane once that was done. We still miss it, obviously. And then once the photons hit those reflectors and bounce into the receivers, this is what the receiver looks like before it was integrated. Again, the 30 gigahertz, the large ones, 44 gigahertz, and the 70s around here. You can see if you look carefully, there's these little horns here are the reference horns, and I'll explain what those are for. They are viewing these little reference loads that are mounted to the outside of HFI. And these are kept at close to 4 Kelvin and are the differential part of the differential receivers that we're looking at. And you can tell just by looking at this, these guys had to be aligned with these little horns to tens of microns when the instrument was put together. So these were mounted on the outside of HFI. So you had to, the engineers and the scientists had to design a way so that HFI could hold these, hold them at 4 Kelvin, hold them to the position with relative to these to within tens of microns, and then be able to make the whole thing buildable. And it was quite a feat. This is what LFI looks like when before it has been integrated. These are the 1 meter long waveguides, over a meter long waveguides that go from the horns over here to the warm back end. And here's one of those receivers, the flight model in test, in a cryo chamber just before testing. There's the horn again. This is the ortho mode transducer that splits the two polarization states. These are the reference horns again for the two receivers. And then these very long, very complex waveguides. Each of these components cost many people years of their lives to create. This is what the receivers look like. This is a schematic. It's called a pseudocorrelation receiver. There are the two horns. The reference horn looks at the reference load. The other horn looks at the sky. And there's a hybrid here, which mixes the signals so that half the sky signal goes and it gets mixed with half the reference load, goes through the first amplifier. So variations in this amplifier are common mode between the two, can be removed later. There's a complementary signal goes through here. There's another hybrid after a phase switch. And you end up with, depending on the state of the phase switches, each of these two detector dials, one's looking at the sky, the other one's looking at the reference, and then they switch at 8 kilohertz. So the outputs of these are alternating signals, which are then differenced in software on board and brought down. This table just gives the raw numbers for LFI. Probably most people have seen them. These now have the flight measurements of sensitivity per unit time and the bandwidth and knee frequencies. It said that LFI worked as well during flight as we expected, which was very well. After initial tuning, basically it's operated incredibly stably for the entire mission, and up until even now it's still operating. We'll go until fall. Here's an example. I'd like to show timelines like Brendan did. This is what the difference thing does for the receiver. This is what the instrument, when it's looking at the sky, looks like. It's noisy. This is what it looks like at the reference. It's also noisy. You take the difference, all of a sudden, the 1 over f from both of them goes away, and you get this measurement. This is the dipole going by with these peaks from the galaxy as we cross it. This is 1,000 seconds worth of data. Even though we get a huge reduction in noise by taking that difference, it's also important to realize we do have these values. So the DC levels can be very important for measurements on the detectors and for increasing our understanding of the receivers and also for calibration. This is what it looks like in time domain. If you were to just take the receivers and look at the sky, you see this is the noise distribution in frequency. This goes down to millihertz. This is the spike you see in the signal as this direct goes by. This is mostly the dipole and also galactic components, all these higher frequency modes, just harmonics of the signal. Again, reference and sky and then difference. And you can see that the 1 over f is just reduced by 3 orders of magnitude. The signal level. This is what the data analysis chain looks like at the pipeline at the DPC in Trieste. I won't go through all of this in detail, but I can show you the basic chunks. There's the first removal of things that have to be done in the timeline, move to find out what gaps might be there and flag data during pointing maneuvers and so on. Then we calculate calculate the difference between the sky and reference load. Combine the diodes together. Now we have one signal for each receiver. And then bring that into here. We do a fit, an iterative calibration to the fit to the dipole, where we get our calibration signal. And the output of that is filtered. We use that gain table to calibrate the COI and then run it into a D-stripe map making. And we get the maps back. So this is a 30 gigahertz map. 44, 70. You can see the galaxy, the galactic components disappearing. And the CMB components staying constant. So we've seen the beautiful maps already, but I wanted to talk about what are the important systematics. And I want to convince you both that we have them, and you have to worry about them, but that they're very well controlled in the current release, and tell you about what we're still working on for the next release. Versus ADC nonlinearity. We do have an ADC nonlinearity, but it's nothing like what the HFI guys have. It is an ADC and it has nonlinearity. That's how they are the same. It's only visible. It's only important in those DC values that I talked about. And it's only visible in a few channels. We have a very effective correction for it, and it's been removed. It's sort of the first stage of data analysis. And I won't talk too much more about it. Then we have what I'm calling additive instrumental effects, so thermal signals coming from the variations in the temperature of various parts and from electronic noise. These are modeled in the case of electronics noise removed. We have calibration, which is a very important systematic a source of potential systematic errors for us. Optics, we've heard about, we'll talk about beam asymmetry in the side lobes, and beam efficiency, which relates to calibration, and the bandpass asymmetry correction. So first, the thermal environment. The instrument was kept quite stable, but not exactly stable. So this is a plot of some of the different relevant temperature stages for LFI. This is the temperature of the reference load as a function of time for the entire nominal mission, months, 15 months. And you can see there are non-trivial variations in the temperature of those loads, although the 70 gigahertz loads were designed to be even more stable than these. And you can see that the RMS there is about 0.13 millikelvin. So in that case, it was very, very stable. There are important jumps here. These happen. This happened here. This change happened when the sorption cooler was switched over from the redundant to the new second sorption cooler at the change of surveys. And so there was a large change in the baseline temperature of the 18 Kelvin, which rippled through to the 4 Kelvin loads. The front end, which is where the amplifiers lie, which is going to be the most sensitive for calibration, It's quite stable until we had adjustments made to the absorption cooler, the 18 Kelvin absorption cooler stage. And you can see here an increase, a great increase in the noise after the absorption cooler switched over. There was a systematic effect, which was understood and then corrected here, but there was a great increase in the noise in the focal plane at that point. And then here you can see the back end. This is the warm electronics, another place where the gain is, the gain of LFI is sensitive to. And what looks like a thick band here is actually a diurnal variation, which we understood and made a change to correct for here. During that time, the spacecraft, the transmitter to bring the data down was being turned on once per day for a few hours to transmit the data. That heated the payload up, and then when it was shut off, it cooled down. That variation was quite significant and visible at several hundred millikelvin on the back ends. And so we saw that. At this point, it was decided to turn it on continuously so we would have a higher thermal load, but it would be constant. You can see that completely went away there. So that's that. So most of the things that happen on this plot are understood, but that doesn't mean we don't have to deal with them for LFI. Okay. One thing that's important to realize is that anything that shows up as an offset, like for instance these variations here, tend to be removed by the destriper when we make maps. And that's why most of these things we actually don't have to worry about in detail. However, we do want to model the effects to make sure we understand how important they can be in the final maps and in the power spectra. And here's an example of how we do that. These are maps made where we take the pointing history of the telescope, and we treat the housekeeping values, like the temperature of the 4 Kelvin load or the correction we make to the ADC, as inputs, and we just map them as if they were CMB signals. And so what you get here is if these things were of order unity impacts on the data, we would see structures like this after the full mapping and process and destriping. ADC correction, some spikes we saw in the electronics, all the thermal effects stuck together, and then a model of what would happen if we estimate the gains wrong. And you can see these are small, I mean, a few microkelvin for each of these. And for each of these different effects. We can take these then and make power spectra of them and compare them to the. So here's sort of a summary plot of how we understand these relatively well-known systematics for LFI. This is just L plus 1 CL on the left and on the vertical scale, and then this is just L. We have a best fits TT spectrum on the top to guide the eye. And we have the noise spectrum from the combined system in blue. And we have all these different effects in these different colors here. And we don't have to go through all of them, but just to give you an idea, the effect of the 1 hertz spikes, the electronics noise I talked about, is measured right here. It's important in high L and kind of unimportant down here. And still many, many orders of magnitude below what we're worried about. The most important effect is, as we'll talk about later, due to the uncertainties in our gain estimation. As the gain varies with time, we have to model it and take it out. So this green line here, A, right along there, it's dominant source of uncertainty, and it becomes important when we compare surveys. So the other important line that's on here is the what we call the half-ring noise. And the survey difference, half-ring noise was mentioned before, is if we take each pointing period of the telescope and we divide it into halves, separately make maps out of them and difference those, that's a very good estimate of the noise. And that's what this blue line is. And it's nice and very well behaved, very straight. And what you notice, though, is that if you then instead take survey differences, take all of survey one, all the data, subtract it from all of survey two, at low frequencies, low L's, you start to see deviations from that pure white noise. So this is the kind of thing we need to understand. Some of this comes from side lobes, and I'll show about some of that later. Some of it can come from gain uncertainty, which is why you see these things. Now, what's useful to note is that we've considered the survey differences to be an upper limit to these kind of systematic effects, and that's what's happening. We take the total of all the things we understand, and they ride just here, just a little bit underneath the survey differences. Okay, so let's talk about some of these in detail. I said I like this plot, but there's one thing not to like about this. The first thing is that these LFI receivers are very far from the sweet spot of the focal plane taken up by HFI. And so one thing that does is it creates aberrations, which is what you can see in this. This is a reconstruction of the various beams for LFI laid out in the focal plane. And you can see clearly the ellipticity here. You can see these are symmetric around this axis, but this horn, for instance, is different from this one. The orientations of these are different. So it's very important to measure these shapes and understand them very well so that you know what you have in the maps. And for LFI, for HFI, we heard from Brendan that these reconstructions are done out to many in about 50 dB using Jupiter. For LFI, with the larger beams, we don't have that signal-to-noise on Jupiter. So what's been done instead is to use the Jupiter transits to update the GRASP model, which is a sort of a geometric theory of diffraction plus physical optics model that describes the telescope. So by updating the telescope model to match the data, I think we have a pretty good handle on what's going on. Then, of course, with those ellipticities, once you build a map, if you imagine those ellipticities riding around on the sky, you have to worry about how they add up for any given pixel. And for Planck, that's been done in general with something called, with a tool called FibiCop, where essentially a little patch is made at low resolution around the sky to tell you what the orientation, the weighted effective orientation and ellipticities of the beam are. And this is just an example of how well that works. These are several sources that are verbed by LFI. This is a 30 gigahertz channel. And you can see the ellipticity, and you can see how the orientation changes around the sky. And then this is what the GPCOP model does for those same pixels. So this just tells you that we now have a tool that tells you exactly where you are in the sky, what the orientation is, and how much it is. So this is what's used to generate the beam window functions. It's very important to use those beam window functions and not some Gaussian approximation, because you will get the wrong answer for the Gaussian. Well, these are both simulations. So, well, actually, no, this is not a simulation. I don't actually know what the signal is on this particular one. So. Oh, this? Yeah, I don't know the details of this particular one. I mean, it could be that this is a double source or something. This is really illustrative, unless somebody wants to comment. He's saying that you can notice a little bad pixel in there. I don't know if you guys want to comment on it, but. So what else isn't there to like about this? Well, you know, it's kind of cool that you can look at this and you can see the focal plane, but it's actually not so cool that you can see the focal plane, because that means the photons can get in ways that you didn't really want to. And so it's important to think about what the spillover issues are with Planck, and that's certainly one of them. And so is the fact that these are so close to the edge that not only are they far from here, they're close to the diffraction edges of the mirror. So this just shows the two main spillover. This is the one we just looked at, where you can see the focal plane from here. And we really think about it turns out to be the scatter across the edge of the secondary, bringing photons into your horn that you didn't want to. And the other is scatters off the top edge of the primary, bringing photons in that you didn't want. So for LFI, the way we model that, because we've got this tuned GRASP model of the payload, we have this. We can generate full 4π measurements of what, or estimates of the sensitivity, and that's what this is. So this is a simulated beam profile where you see the main lobe, you see the near side lobes, you see these far side lobes, and you can see this bump. And you can identify each of these with those paths that we talked about, the larger ones here. But this model then can be used with a model of the sky or with a first order map of the sky to estimate how much signal we get from the side lobes. Here's one of those simulations. This is a 30 gigahertz simulation where the GRASP model is not just a single frequency model, but one that's been weighted. It's been measured in multiple bands and then weighted by the known band pass of the 30 gigahertz receivers and then summed. And what you're looking at here is the survey one. It's a little cut here from missing data, survey one, and then survey two. And the reason you see such a large difference is, as Brendan pointed out, that side lobe looks along the spin axis of the payload. So at one point, it's looking away from the galaxy, but in the other survey, it's looking towards the galaxy. So at the position when you're looking at that, we happen to be at these rings here, which is why you get a large signal, this big ring. Now those are hard to see. If you look at the signal, it's not tiny, but it's going to be hard to see in our full maps, right? There's a lot of signal to compare to. This is a 30 microkelvin peak-to-peak signal. But if you generate the difference, survey 2 minus survey 1, okay, then this thing comes out very clearly here. This is still the simulation, and it's quite bright. And you looked at, this is what you get if you do it with the data. And I apologize, I do survey 1 minus survey 2, and that was survey 2 minus survey 1, but this is our big ring here. This thing here is the signature of the side lobes in the 30 gigahertz receiver. Now, when we first started looking at side lobes, my first reaction was to say, okay, we've got this model, and that's a model, which means we're going to have to fit it to within factors of 2, and we don't know how well it's going to work. But if you just directly subtract that model from the data, this is what you get. So you get a really nice removal of that ring without doing any funny business at all. There's no fudging at all. So this gave me, at least, a lot of confidence that GRASP model that we currently have is going to be a pretty good measure of the side lobes. And it makes it so that I feel more confident in using it to do things like measure beam efficiency or estimate the size of the side lobes at 70 gigahertz. To that end, I wanted to just bring up this one table that's in the LFI beams paper, which I think is useful when you're thinking about calibration issues. And that is that you want to understand how much of your signal is coming from places other than the main lobe. And one way to do that is what we call beam efficiency, or this right here, this fractional percent in the side lobes. And this gives you an idea of what is outside of what is considered the main lobe for LFI for each of the channels. And you can see the numbers are all quite small. And to first order, signals like that for LFI that are far from the main lobe are taken out or corrected for in the way we do the calibration, because of the calibration is also, as long as these are orthogonal to the dipole, then you end up with correcting them directly in the calibration. So this is the size of the error that we think we could have, and we think we've taken out first order in sort of calibration level. And this is where more work is going to happen in the next for the next release, and that is that comparisons using these models and taking these frequencies out to 100 gigahertz and doing the same thing at HFI and then trying to use HFI techniques for LFI will give us even more cross checks than we currently have for these discrepancies. It's the fractional percent of solid angle, weighted solid angle coming from outside the main lobe. So this. It depends on what you mean by beam. So, I mean, the main lobe is the part that's included in the Shidikov beams, right? This is what fraction, and this is in percent. So this is 0.66% is not included in that. No, from everything outside of I think it's 2.5 degrees. Have the number on here, but it's a few degrees, yeah. So it includes everything, including what Brendan calls near side lobes. It's a little easier for us with GRASP because you can choose where you do the cut rather than relying on. It's corrected for in the sense that the way we do our calibration automatically corrects for this, the first order. We don't have to re-correct for this number because the calibration is assuming what's called a pencil beam, essentially. You don't have to recalibrate by these numbers. This is just an estimate of how big the effect could be if it were there. It's tenths of a percent. I mean, it's nowhere near the 2.5% people I'm talking about. Calibration. So there's more than one method that's been applied to the LFI calibration. But there's really just two classes. There's a solar dipole calibration, where in the time domain when we know where we're pointed, we estimate the solar dipole. We use the solar speed and direction from WMAP as our inputs. Then we create a calibration. We take the result of that calibration. We subtract it from the data, and we end up with residuals. Use those residuals to improve your estimate of the signal, remove the signal so you get a better measurement of the dipole, and then iterate that. So the idea is to minimize the contamination from the galaxy on your estimate of the dipole. That procedure converges, and you end up with a calibration. The signal noise is relatively low, and and I'll show you on the next plot, it's not so great for some period of time where the dipole is low. And at 30 gigahertz, the contamination from the side lobes I showed you can be significant. And so at the moment, rather than correct for that in the time domain, we're using an alternative calibration for 30 gigahertz, which relies on those DC levels from the radiometers. Basically, you can use those to generate a calibration that's essentially independent of this one. You use a single overall normalization. That's the one that's dependent on the ABC nonlinearity. So we rely on the survey differences to guide choices. So when we make a calibration, then we can compare the survey 1 to survey 2, survey 1 to survey 3, and see if there's deviations. And those large dipole or large features can tell us when we've got some problems. So this gives you an idea of what those calibrations look like. This is what those iterative dipole calibrations look like over time. They're solutions. They're quite noisy in particular, where the dipole is a minimum. This is a plot of the amplitude of the dipole as a function of time. This is the days after launch. And these are the two estimates. One is, this is the level of the DC level coming out. And then this is the calibration we're using. So in the case of the 30 gigahertz receivers, this DC value is essentially inverted and scaled to produce this calibration, all these variations that are capturing those things we saw in the thermal plot. At 70 gigahertz, we basically are taking this and smoothing it with a function that minimizes the excess noise from these things to get this plot. So that's our calibration. We do a lot of comparisons internally to see whether we trust these calibrations. This is just one version of that. This is by using the first acoustic peak. We basically calculate spectra, and we average them around the first acoustic peak and compare them to each other. This plot is all normalized for the 70 gigahertz full frequency channels, and these are the individual subbands, giving you an estimate of the scatter among these guys. You can see here there's significant deviation from 30 gigahertz, and if you can see, as we change sky fraction, that changes a lot. So what we're seeing here is really foregrounds. So again, this is the sort of test we do to convince ourselves that we understand the calibration internal consistency. And then last, I just wanted to reemphasize this. This is the fundamental thing we do for checking consistency. This is, again, best fit temperature spectrum. And these are the survey difference and half-ring difference for 70 gigahertz. You can see there's almost no difference here at all. And then this is the difference of the spectra. So this tells us we really, really understand. We don't have any significant systematics, even to relatively low L, as measured this way. 44 gigahertz, and at 30, you can see again stuff happening here. Some of this is just due to the side lobes, because this is a survey 1-2 difference. But this is where our current work is going. So what's next? Polarization, obviously. We're very excited to get 70 gigahertz to the point where we can do cosmology with a low L polarization. And the things that we'll be working on, although they're small, we want to complete the graphs calculations. To date, we've only done the weighted graphs calculations at 30 gigahertz. So we have a lot of work going on right now to do that, the same things for 44 and 70. They've been done at single frequencies, and we know they're small, but they haven't been done to the way we can include them in the pipeline. So we'd be including that directly in the pipeline and effectively removing a five side lobe response in the time domain. Then we're investigating other calibration schemes. From those plots I showed you, you saw there's a lot of variation there. It doesn't take very much error in that to generate blobs in the survey differences, and that's what we'll be concentrating on, is improving those so that the survey differences become clean and those spectra then match the half rings. And there's a bunch of things being computed right now, so we don't know the answer on that yet, but we will have something working. And then what's last? We've been discussing I mentioned a few times in talking to people about what's going to happen to Planck. Planck has been extended and extended because the cooler has been operating longer and longer than anybody expected. So LFI is operating right now. At the moment, we are sure, almost certain, to get 8 full surveys, which would take us to the end of August. And then Planck will be moved into a stable Earth trailing orbit in October and essentially shut down. So we'll be stopping in October early, but we'll be observing up until then. And there may or may not be a sorption pillar regeneration as a test before we actually switch it off. And that's it. So, yeah. Thank you.
For the polarization, so in HFI paper, they show this contribution from bandpass mismatch and calibration mismatch as a function of multiple. Do you have similar plot for the LFI?
I don't have one in here. In general, so the bandpass mismatch is the same effect, right? We have two different gains, and depending on what kind of source you're looking at, they may not be matched. It turns out, though, that we have a pretty good handle on it. Although the bandpasses were not measured as well as we would like on ground, by looking at known sources during the flight, we've actually got a procedure for measuring, correcting for that in line. That's actually working very well, and it's really only important where there's significant foregrounds. If you look at 70 gigahertz and then you ask how much the correction is, we know the correction to a few percent. The correction itself is only a few percent. It turns out not to be important, as far as we can tell. Although it is an important known systematic, I actually don't think it'll be dominant at all for 70 gigahertz polarization.
Oh, okay. So I guess, so I was looking at this ISLAV presentation of polarization of LFI. They have this very nice plot of the E-mode measurement in low L. That looks pretty good. Do you have a feeling for how far you can beat it down, the systematic errors, in terms of the amplitude of B-mode power spectrum?
I don't have a number for it. Okay. I'm much more concentrating on passing our null test before I look at the results, which is good.
Everything's so clear with LFI. No questions.
So how many servers you will have in the end? Eight?
Eight, yeah.
And what is the sensitivity then?
Well, right now, so with 1.5. We should be somewhere around 5, I think, but I'd have to do it per channel. So these are the current sensitivities right here, and we can expect factors of 2 or 3.
So following up on that, not that this is a beauty contest, but how much better will 8 surveys do than a certain other experiment?
Yes.
That's not a number I calculate every day, but it should be about a factor of 5. But I still quote me on it because I didn't calculate it for this question, which I should have anticipated.
Even for polarization?
What's that?
Even for polarization, this factor of 5?
I don't see why it should be different, but maybe somebody else can help me answer.
I'm not suggesting it's different, I just don't know.
That's not something I calculated, actually. But a factor of 5 is what we expect, I think, just from low sensitivity.
But isn't it better designed for polarization than the radiometers on WMET, which was not the target, although it was really great that it did it?
No, but neither one of them is really designed for polarization.
To tell you this problem we were struggling with. And I was also struck and actually very pleased by seeing this ISLAV presentation of the noise power spectrum from survey differences. So one of the unexpected inflation of the noise we saw in the B-mode power spectrum relative to E-mode was that we scanned, so we have difference measurements.
Right.
So we're taking differences. These differences will give you the correlated noise. That will give the spike in the correlation function of the noise. In Fourier space, it becomes ringing. And that ringing gets enhanced, you know, for whatever reason, we don't have any qualitative explanation for, but it has the spike at the end of 3 in the B-mode power spectrum, plus enhanced noise level, generally speaking, low L, which you don't seem to have at all, because you don't have this noise correlation at 140 degrees or whatever, because you're using cold low difference. So that really gives you the enormous sensitivity improvement in the low L part of the power spectrum, much more than you would expect naively from the noise level. So this is very nice, and looking forward to see that.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, it's something that that early on a lot of people, including to some extent us, thought was a bad thing about LFI, or Planck in general, is the fact that we don't have as many crossings to generate to find the solutions for every given pixel, particularly in polarization. turns out not to have been important. What's more important for us, at least, is that we have all these incredible redundancies, so we can dice and slice the data many different ways, especially now with all these surveys. We can get a lot of confidence and look at cross-spectra and look at comparisons. And like you say, I mean, I'm shocked as well that the survey differences look as good as they do. So that's why we have a great hope that we're going to do very well for this, with the caveat that right now we don't. Right now, if we were passing the null test statistically, then you'd be seeing the polarization results now. But we're in the middle of doing that. And I think, like I said, calibration is our prime focus.
So given the shutting down in October, when can we expect the final completo results?
Well, I mean, there are, right now, as far as I understand, there are two releases planned. There's one that'll happen in the middle of next year, which is going to be polarization. And then there's going to be another one considered a cleanup, I think, about a year later. But I don't know if they're set in stone about exactly when.
Okay, shall we move on to what I know everybody has been on the edge, and they should be, because we don't get anything out without component separation of one sort or another, whether in power spectrum or in maps. And Carlo's going to unveil how the veils were lifted.